90.3 FM and to Older Women Live, feminist radio heard the second Wednesday of every month. My name is Rosemary Wally, and today we're gearing up to celebrate an event of great importance. Something wonderful is about to happen, and if it were not for COVID, we'd be dancing in the street. On the 22nd of this month, in 9 days' time, nuclear weapons become illegal under international law. To talk about this monumental event, the entering into force of the Treaty for the Prohibition of Nuclear Weapons, we're joined this evening by two peace activists, and also we're joined in spirit by a Canadian treasure, Setsuko Thurlow, who survived the bombing of Hiroshima in 1945. And she lives in Toronto, and she's well into her 80s now. But she's devoted her life to warning people about the danger of nuclear war. We also have a bit of anti-war music, as well as ways in which you, the listeners, can get involved to get rid of these weapons in our one world that we have. Let's just listen to a little bit of Setsuko. We're going to start by hearing Setsuko Thurlow, who survived Hiroshima, as she accepts the Nobel Peace Prize on behalf of the International Campaign for the Elimination of Nuclear Weapons.
My fellow campaigners, on behalf of all the remarkable human beings who form ICAN movement, I speak as a member of the family of Hibakusha, those of us who survived the atomic bombing of Hiroshima and Nagasaki. For more than 7 decades, we have been working hard for the total abolition of nuclear weapons. We are not content to be victims. We refuse to wait for a fiery end. We Hibakusha have been waiting for the ban for 72 years. Let this be the beginning of the end of nuclear weapons. When I was a 13-year-old girl trapped in the smoldering rubble, I kept pushing, I kept moving toward the light, and I survived. Our light now is a banned treaty. I repeat those words that I heard in the ruins of Hiroshima. Don't give up. Keep pushing. Keep moving. See the light. Crawl toward it. Let us follow each other out of the dark night of nuclear terror. This is our passion, our commitment for our one precious world to survive.
Nancy Covington, you're one of our guests. You're from Halifax, and then we zip over to the other side of the country, to Victoria, to speak to Mary Wynne Ashford. Nancy belongs to the group International Physicians for the Prevention of Nuclear War Canada. So tell us about your organisation and tell us about your involvement, Nancy.
Okay, well, our affiliate, the International Physicians for the Prevention of Nuclear War Canada, are the Canadian affiliate of the international group of the same name. I will start kind of at the beginning of how I became involved with the various campaigns to get rid of nuclear weapons. Growing up in Ottawa during the Cold War era, I witnessed bomb shelters being built, fallout shelters, they were called. You were supposed to go in them for a month, take a month's supply of food with you. And then they said, when you came out, there'd be nuclear winter. As a child, I thought this was totally ridiculous. Coming out with perpetual winter, how would you grow your food? Well, unfortunately, the situation is very similar today. In fact, some people think worse. The two exceptions, the way it's not similar, are that people are more unaware. We don't build bomb shelters these days. And the other thing is people think that the Cold War is over. And it's true, the number of nuclear weapons are about a quarter of what they were at the peak. However, there is modernization has been going on. And hence they think the risk may be worse. Using 1% of the world's arsenal, just imagine only 1% of those 13,000 existing weapons would kill millions instantly. And secondly, cause widespread nuclear winter, which would cause more deaths from starvation and from the violence. Helen Caldicott came along. And as you know, she is a lady, if you love this planet fame, and dubbed nuclear weapons as a health issue, a public health issue. In fact, she called it the ultimate public health issue. In those days, in the 70s, 80s, physicians from across the Iron Curtain met in international conferences. They were discussing normal illnesses that affect mankind, but a group of them felt that, my goodness, these nuclear weapons are more of a threat to our patients than the diseases we're discussing. So they started the International Physicians for the Prevention of Nuclear War. In those days, they emphasized that the energy, resources, money spent on nuclear weapons and militarism could be better allocated to other issues affecting mankind, poverty, pandemics even, diseases. And of course, now we say the same thing, but we add climate change issues and of course the pandemics. They also said there's no meaningful medical response to the effects of a nuclear catastrophe, so prevention is the key. Other organizations, of course, have said the same thing. International Red Cross, for instance. Now, this group has affiliates all across all the world. And they, in the early days in the 80s, they worked very hard, spoke to a lot of politicians in US and USSR. And for their efforts in decreasing the tension in the Cold War era, they were awarded the Nobel Peace Prize in 1985. Now we jump forward to 2007.
No, I was going to say that now with this pandemic, we're hearing a lot about how hospitals are full and how it's getting to be a dire situation. And that's just this little COVID. I mean, it's unbelievable. People do not realize, I think, that a nuclear catastrophe would wipe out everything. All the hospitals, the beds, doctors, everything that we know in our health system.
Precisely, precisely. And look, they were criticized. The world is criticized for not fully preparing for a pandemic. How could they possibly prepare? They can't for a nuclear weapons Holocaust. It's impossible. Absolutely. So prevention is the key. 2007, the Australian affiliate of IPPNW came bouncing in with their kangaroo suits with a catchy acronym of ICAN, international campaign to abolish nuclear weapons. ICANN, of course, rapidly became an entity of its own. In 2007, and this is where Suzuko fits in. Actually, she made a presentation on Parliament Hill, one of her trademark passionate speeches during the launch of ICANN. Okay, 2007. Turns out that Canada was the first country in the world to formally launch ICANN in a House of Parliament. Many other countries followed suit. But of course, unfortunately, we know Canada subsequently fell behind in our pathway that we had established for years in pursuing nuclear weapons abolition. ICANN's original goal was to develop a nuclear weapons convention. Now, a convention is just another word for a treaty. They didn't care what it was called or exactly what would be in it, but they wanted to get rid of these weapons. And to do this, they hosted three humanitarian conferences. Now, why humanitarian? They were trying to change the rhetoric of the discussion of nuclear weapons away from the theory of deterrence to the obvious effect of nuclear weapons, that they kill people. These three conferences took place in Norway, Austria, and Mexico. Delegates from every single country in the world were invited to all of these conferences. And of note, Canada did not attend a single one of these. In 2017, in July, they felt prepared to go to the United Nations. Again, delegates from around the world were invited. And they worked for several weeks and hashed out the exact words of the treaty of the prohibition of nuclear weapons, which we have today, and which is becoming international law in 10 days. Yes, exactly. In December of that year, 2017, the Nobel Peace Prize was awarded to ICANN for its efforts in producing this monumental historic treaty. The co-recipient of that prize was Suzuko. The treaty is considered robust in its mentioning of what is to be done during its procedures. The treaty is signed by originally by 122 countries and currently ratified by 51. And a ratification simply means a process that a given country has gone through in their government so that everybody is informed of what they would have to do in the treaty. The way these United Nations treaty works are that at 50 ratifications, the process is triggered such that 90 days later, there will be entry into force, which for the case of the Treaty on the Prohibition of Nuclear Weapons is January 22nd.
So that's when we can get out the balloons and the champagne.
That's right. That's right. There will be a big celebration.
Yeah.
There are a few little catches, though. We've always considered these weapons immoral, and they will be declared illegal, but the catch is they're only going to be illegal for those countries who have signed. So, of course, the countries which have not signed are include the nuclear weapons have countries and the umbrella countries under them, which unfortunately includes Canada. 122 have signed, which doesn't mean ratifying.
No, but signed, 51 have ratified.
And I think there are 190 countries all told. Now, the hope, of course, of ICANN campaign is that more and more countries will see fit to actually join. Now, once the treaty has entered into force, a country can no longer sign or ratify. They have to accede to the treaty, which is just a different process. It means that it would be brought up in Parliament, and the lawmakers would say, yes, we agree to the tenets of the treaty and will abide by them. So that is the place we are at with our country, Canada, which was always a leader in terms of nuclear weapons abolition talk for years and years and years. And we think could still be a leader. And that is why there are groups around pressing the government to at least debate the issue in Parliament. And of course, the petition we have started does more than debate. We call on the government to accede to or join the treaty. Of course, some people will criticize the fact that, it's the nuclear have nations that won't sign at the moment. And so what does that matter? They have the weapons. But it turns out that treaties, such as for the landmines that haven't been signed by the countries that have these weapons, once everybody else signs it, they go along with it anyway. So that is the hope for this treaty. The more countries that sign, the more the moral force is out there.
Well, thank you very much for explaining that. For those who have just joined us, you're listening to CKUT at 90.3 FM. I'm Rosemary Wally. This is Older Women Live, and we're going to start and listen to some music now. We're going to hear another song now called I Come and Stand at Every Door, and it's sung by a British pop group from the 80s called This Mortal Coil.
On the floating shipless oceans, I did all my best to smile to your singing eyes and fingers drew me as riddled as the time. should I lie with death, my bride? Hear me sing, swim to me, swim to me.
Okay, Mary Wynne Ashford, could we just turn to you? You are also very involved in this issue.
I am very involved. I've been involved since 1984, also because of Dr. Helen Caldicott, the Australian pediatrician who spoke out here. And I was so shocked by what she had to tell us about what happens to human beings in a nuclear blast that I thought, I have to work against these. I can't stand the idea that I might be on the outskirts of Victoria and survive if our military base had been bombed and there would be nothing I could do, nothing, absolutely nothing helpful in the case of that many victims and no hospitals and no burn units and no antibiotics. Anyway, the reason that I love this treaty, the Treaty on the Prohibition of Nuclear Weapons, is it's the people's treaty. And I'm just going to expand a bit on what Nancy was saying. When Norway set up the first of those three conferences, they did it because they were completely fed up with the United Nations debating endlessly about nuclear prohibition or nuclear disarmament, gradual and slow and so on, because it didn't get anywhere. And so they copied what Canada had done about landmines. And that's when Foreign Minister then, Lloyd Axworthy, said, I'm calling on like-minded countries to come to Ottawa to talk about banning landmines and then to write a treaty, which succeeded. And so that's called the Ottawa process. So Norway decided to use the Ottawa process, and they invited countries who wanted to talk not about deterrence, not about security, but about the humanitarian consequences of nuclear explosions. And that includes not just the people killed and burned and all the destruction of that, but also the consequences for agriculture, for the world's financial system, for, well, just for people all over the world, particularly from fallout, but also, as Nancy pointed out, because the debris that would go up into the stratosphere would linger there for years and years and blot out the sun. So it would truly be nuclear winter and crop failure and starvation. They estimate for a limited exchange between India and Pakistan would end up with 2 billion people dead. So that's the ongoing problem. But now about what I've said, it's the People's Treaty. Norway did this very radical thing. And instead of just inviting the speakers from each country to talk about humanitarian consequences, they invited civil society experts. So for the first time, all of these delegates who are led by appointed government, they represent the government as ambassadors. So they're there listening to these experts. And for the first time, they learn about the real consequences of a nuclear blast and what it would be like on their country. So it was presentations by physicists and doctors and people from the different financial institutions and agriculture and so on. And the delegates were so shocked that they demanded a follow-up meeting right away. And that one was held in Mexico. And again, the delegates just said, we can't leave this. We have to have a treaty. And that's why it moved then to Austria. And it was the Austrian government at the end of that conference stood up and said, okay, we will be responsible for taking this to the General Assembly. I want to talk about the youth and the extraordinary involvement of youth. I was talking to one of the American delegates and I said, tell me about what young people were doing, because I heard they were involved. And he said, that in ICANN, 90% of the volunteers who were there are under the age of 30. So that meant that these delegations were surrounded by young people who were saying to them, oh, I see that you're looking for something. Would you like the Spanish translation of that document? I'll run and get it for you. Or would you like me to have that printed up for you for distribution? And by the end of the conferences, that one of the key leaders, Tilman Ruff, Dr. Tilman Ruff from Australia, said to me, you know, those young people were writing notes for the delegates. They were writing explanations. In some cases, they were actually writing speeches to help them out. That's an extraordinary contribution. At any one time when the whole conference was going on, there would be 100 volunteers. Can you imagine the difference that would make if you had 100 volunteers with the energy that they bring, that they really want this to work? Mm-hmm. So the contribution of young people was just enormous. And I love another story that I was told, which was that when the very first delegations arrived in Norway, they were greeted at the conference center by young people who were standing on the stairs, and they had these big placards. And the placard said, thank you for coming. Now that's so different for an official delegation to be welcomed in that way. I think that went a long way to set the tone. So now in following up, people all over the world are meeting with their city governments and saying, look, our country, and this is not just Canada, our country isn't signing this treaty, but cities are the targets in the event of a nuclear blast. We need to say to our country, to our government, get behind this. You must sign this treaty because we are the ones who would be destroyed. We would be killed. And we found with every presentation that we do to a city government, it's passed unanimously, instantly. There's not a big debate about, oh no, we need our security. It's, I didn't know that cities were the targets. I didn't know that Canada hadn't signed. So, excuse me, we need to continue with that pressure. And wherever you live, whether you live in a village or just a small municipality, you can go to your municipal government. And if they sign a statement saying that they want to have their country accede now to the Treaty on the Prohibition of Nuclear Weapons, and they sign on, then they get featured on the webpage of ICANN. And we will continue to do that until there are so many cities signed up that the federal government will have to comply. It will be obviously the wish of the people. And the other thing is the petition that Nancy mentioned that is so important. And I think you're putting a link on that on the Voice of Women webpage. The other thing that I want to talk about is a particular concern of young people. I talk about young people because I go out to the high schools and universities to speak about this issue all the time. And I find that young people are really shocked to learn that we still have almost 14,000 nuclear weapons on the earth today. And as I've said, an exchange of about 100 on each side would spell the end of life in the Northern Hemisphere for sure. So the other issue that concerns youth is climate change, and it isn't really a separate issue. At the moment, the world is spending about $1.7 trillion dollars every year on its militaries. And in the United States, it's close to a trillion that they plan to spend on nuclear weapons and the modernization and the storage and so on of nuclear weapons, which cannot ever be used. Now, imagine if they stopped using that money and put that money into healthcare, education, mitigating the effects of climate change, switching to sustainable energy. There are so many things, getting rid of plastics in the oceans, all of these things that we need to have done. And I like to say, you know, the Security Council at the UN is not really addressing the issues of our security today. Our security is threatened by a pandemic and it's threatened by the military. It's not made secure by the military. It's threatened by this huge expansion of militarism worldwide. So the other thing about climate change and the militaries is that the world's militaries all combined are the greatest users of petroleum products on Earth. They are the biggest polluters and they are the biggest producers of greenhouse gases, but they are not responsible to report to the governmental panels on climate change. So all those big meetings like the Paris Accords and so on, the military are exempted. And that certainly is not adding to our security. So those are the major things that are important about this treaty. And as Nancy said, even if the great powers don't sign, the United States in particular is very much aware of how much this treaty would affect them. And they in fact wrote to NATO countries to say, don't get involved with this, don't sign this treaty, because the treaty prohibits countries from owning, transporting, hosting, training their officers to use them. It excludes the threat or the use of nuclear weapons. And it said it would actually make it impossible for us to continue our nuclear program. And we're all saying, well, yes, that's the whole purpose of the treaty, is to prohibit the nuclear weapon states from using them. And once the treaty has a few more signatures, people will start to say, nuclear weapons are illegal. Why are we still allowing the submarines to come into our harbor? Why is there a submarine going through Puget Sound near me? Why are there still bases in other countries housing nuclear weapons? And that will bring the whole change in our atmosphere about them, because they're not to be admired. They're a disgrace to our civilization.
I think what's interesting, what's really exciting here about what you're talking about, Mary Wynne, is that I can remember being a very young activist and marching, you know, banning the bomb out.
Yeah.
60 years ago or something. But I never felt that I had any power or anything. And of course, I had no knowledge and I was just a little nothing. You see. There was nothing I could do. I've got no agency. But I think that with this TPNY, we actually have agency. This is like a tool that any individual, no matter who they are, can use. You can go and you can knock on City Hall or something.
That's right. You can,
yes. So I think that's really, really exciting. But for those of us who are psychologically have no power, no control over anything, that gives us something. It's a moral weapon, isn't it?
It's a moral weapon. It's so interesting, this sense of being powerless, because I can remember when I started as an activist, and it's almost 40 years ago now, that I would meet with government officials, and I always had that feeling of powerlessness. They would be people about my age, and I would be telling them about nuclear weapons, and I'd be so desperate, and I felt like I'm knocking and knocking on this door, and no one's answered. But now, I'm much older. I now meet these people who have retired, and they say, you have no idea how important it was that we heard from you all those times at all those government meetings. So don't ever think that what you say is inconsequential. The people who are listening to you are being affected by it, even though, you know, because of their jobs, they can't show it, but they talk about it later.
So let's just sort of broaden the issue now a little bit. I think it was Nancy who mentioned Canada. What can we do to put pressure on Canada to sign this treaty? I mean, this is so shameful that our country has so far refused to do this. They're sort of like hiding behind the bushes almost.
Yeah, it is. And it's so unlike Canada. You know, in the 80s, Canada was known as a leader at the United Nations. And I must say, I'd be there as an observer, and I was so impressed by our diplomats and the way they could change wording of a treaty under discussion and make it so that all the sides could agree, but it still said what we wanted. And they're extremely expert at doing that. And now we're not doing that now. We're not taking the lead. We need to do that again. But in terms of what we can do, besides, you can phone your local MP's office, you don't have to know a huge amount. You can just say, look, I want Canada to sign this treaty to abolish nuclear weapons. And you can leave that message on their telephone if you want to. You can write them a postcard or a letter, and you don't even have to put a stamp on it. You can say the simplest sentence, I want you to support the treaty to prohibit nuclear weapons. And for young people, well, there are two things I like to say about youth. One is that if they speak in public anywhere where there's a television camera, the camera will go right to them because they are beautiful, they are idealistic, and they are willing to speak out. And they are such a magnet for television. So always remember that the youth in your group will magnify the impact of that meeting, whatever it is. The other thing is, if young people in their schools talk to their other classes and say, did you know about this? Did you know what nuclear weapons do? They can spread the word, and that's what needs to happen.
I was just going to say another avenue for people that's quite easy to use is to go on the ICANN website. I can do it too. Just remember ICANN. And it has letters that you can send to your city hall counselors about the appeal that the cities, ICANN cities appeal, that cities can send a letter to the federal government. And it's right there. You don't need to know a whole lot of the history. You just want to get rid of these things. They exist. You want to get rid of them.
Well, there are some cities in Canada that have done that, yeah? Mm-hmm. Nuclear-free cities.
Absolutely. Montreal, Victoria, Toronto, Vancouver, and then a whole series of little ones around Victoria. Halifax, I missed you, Nancy.
Last summer, and we combined our event with the fact that Hiroshima had been bombed exactly 75 years ago. So it's always nice to link it to some event like that, that no one can really argue with.
ICANN is also collecting photographs of people standing with a sign that says, nuclear weapons now illegal, January 22nd, 2021. And they're taking their pictures wherever there is something of significance. In my case, it's the fact that I'm looking right across the strait. I live in Victoria, so I'm looking right across to the nuclear submarine base in Washington State. So then all of those go to ICANN, and there'll be a huge collage of people across the world. So you can just do that on your phone.
And in Halifax here, we've been aware for years that these submarines and vessels that come into our harbors are flying under what they call neither confirm nor deny policy. In other words, we can't find out whether they really have nuclear weapons on board. And sometimes we've been out there with the banner saying such and such a vessel is in town. And now we can say nuclear weapons are illegal. Are they on this ship?
Yes. What are they doing here? Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Why do you think that the media has been so silent? I mean, for those of us in the know, we know that the 22nd of January is a huge deal, you know, because these weapons become illegal. But when you're talking about, you know, the events that work the way up to this, there's never anything in the regular media about it. Why not?
It's extraordinary. It's not on people's mind because there has been a steady decrease in the number of weapons up until maybe 7 or 8 years ago when it got frozen around 14,000. But there isn't public discussion about the issue. So when I speak in high schools, these young people have never heard the real story of what happens in a nuclear explosion. All that they have is images from science fiction.
This is a beautiful anti-war song sung by a young folk singer from Ontario. Her name is Doris Falkins. The song is called All Our Roses, And it's the story of how the family home in Hamburg was bombed during the Second World War.
Summer was green. The city was bright. But rumors of war blew in the wind. We hid in our homes as deep darkness spread and all our
knows what's happening to Prince Harry and Meghan. So yeah. That's in the media. So why isn't this very important issue, far more important than Dear Meghan and Prince Harry, why isn't this, at least, even if it's not on page one, then on page two?
No, it isn't there at all. I think it's because our media is so concentrated in the United States and we follow their pattern. And the military-industrial complex actually includes the media and Hollywood as part of that massive complex. And that promotes all of these ideas about security. There's a huge promotion of fear of the other and fear of attack and so on that keeps that going. But there isn't a counterbalance that's saying we need peace and we need to be able to promote peace. It's hard for it to compete with Harry and Meghan. peace doesn't have that great drama associated with it.
Yeah, the culture of peace is not exciting, I suppose. But in terms of it's we the people that need to constantly tell our media that we'd like to talk about these issues. For instance, a cross-country checkup might have the question of, should Canada sign the treaty? And you get all sorts of viewpoints, but at least it would bring it out in the open. And I think the more people that contact CBC and make that request, it might actually happen because people will know other people are interested in it.
I think we'd be better actually to go on social media because, you know, like who listens to cross-country checkup besides us? You know?
Besides us. Yeah.
But very, very few. You know, there are certain whole groups that they don't get to, that don't know that exist or are not interested. I mean, we need like a good Twitter account like Donald Trump had to promote, because it's a very, very important issue. I actually got to talk to my MP, who had never heard of this issue at all.
Exactly.
And I was saying, are you still left? She said, I'm taking notes. Well, wait a minute, she's taking notes of what I say. I don't know whether my MP is typical of not being really, let's just say, tuned into this issue. I don't know about the other MPs.
Well, in my experience recently, Rosemary, my colleague Jonathan Down, he's a pediatrician, the two of us went out and we were speaking to high school students and service clubs. This is before we were locked up, locked down. We spoke to 2,000 people 2 years ago. And what we found was that the elderly like me had forgotten what it was like. And at the end of our talks, they would say, oh, I just feel sick. I had no idea what nuclear weapons do. And I said, but you and I were protesting together, you know, only 20 years ago. And he said, I know, but I have forgotten how frightening this is. So with the older ones, they've put it out of their minds. And anyone who's under 40 really grew up after the end of the Soviet Union, 1991. And so if they've grown up since then, it's not been discussed. It's not in the media. Like, it's never discussed at anybody's dinner table, except mine and Nancy's. Excuse me. But we have to start, and that's where I really like working with the young people. We have two young students working for us in the International Physicians Group. So they have us on all versions of social media. And we just have to keep remembering to put something on, because something does come up almost every day. When Kim Jong-un and Donald Trump were threatening each other with fire and fury, we were really frightened. Our American colleagues had said it looked to them like it was 50-50 whether there would be a nuclear attack in that first March in 2017 after he took office. So that's when we became really active. Now that's quietened down, but has it really quietened down? Or is it just that it's not on the front page anymore?
I think another aspect is the military-industrial complex. You know, like a lot of scientists are working for the betterment of these nuclear weapons.
Ah, that's true.
Mm-hmm. I think it's over 25% of all scientists are somehow involved in military stuff.
Well, I think they've also been sold the myth of security and deterrence, and this is how they will attain it. I did hear a story about a particular factory in one of the states in the United States that produced these weapons, and it was sufficiently small that they felt that they could even just buy off and pension off all the workers there that were making these things. But they didn't want that. The people felt that they were doing something for the security of their country, and that's they didn't want to be turned into plowshares or pensioned off. So somehow I think getting in the culture of peace, a different type of security. Security doesn't come from these weapons, but we have to replace it with something.
And we have to, if we're going to change, particularly in the major states that we're concerned about, the U.S. and Russia, then we have to ensure that those people are employed. And at this point, we now know the kinds of medical equipment and so on that we need in order to be prepared for the next pandemic. And so there's this thing about in-group thinking. And as Nancy said, it is this thinking about what makes us secure. And we need to make it clear what we need for our security, especially now, with climate change and with the pandemic and with our seas dying and all of these other things that we need to address.
Yes, what we need, maybe we can go through what we need for our security, food, love.
Yeah, shelter, companionship, yes. But, you know,
services, we do not need weapons, yeah. We don't need guns.
One of the big things that keeps coming up is the issue of trust. And how we're losing trust in authority. And I think that is a place where we need to work right at our local level about trust and about the responsibility of everyone who is elected to office. Everyone who's in a position of trust has to be trustworthy. And we really, really need to regain that, because I think that's a quality that we've lost.
Sorry, our time has once again trickled away. And I'd really like to thank Nancy Covington and Mary Wynne Ashford for their thoughts, their ideas, their compassion, their expertise today. We're going to leave you with some music and stay tuned to our next program, which is Amandla. If you'd like more information about this all-important topic, the treaty for the prohibition of nuclear weapons and how you can get involved, and it's very, very important that people as individuals get involved. There's some more information available at a few of these sites. You can go to World Beyond War. You can go to the ICAN site itself, the International Campaign for the Abolition of Nuclear Weapons, ICAN. You can also go to the physician's site, which is the ippnw/canada.com. And there are a couple of films that maybe you would find informative. I'm not saying you're going to enjoy these films, but they are very good. There was a film that was made in the early 80s by the National Film Board of Canada with all our tax dollars. And it features Helen Caldicott. So that's C-A-L-D-I-C-O-T-T. She's a physician from Australia. And the film is called If You Love This Planet. And it's very, very gripping, especially the section on the effects of the nuclear bomb on the human body. There's also a more recent film, which is available on the World Beyond War website, as well as the Canadian Network to Abolish Nuclear Weapons. And this is the actor Martin Sheen. It's a 12-minute film. I forget the name of it, actually, but anyway, it's there. If you'd like to sign the petition, this is on the House of Commons website, the petition asking that Canada, demanding that Canada join this world initiative to get rid of nuclear weapons. It's petition number 3028, and we're certainly looking for a lot more signatures than we have.
When your parents need your help, you're there. When your kids say something's wrong, you're there. When your friends have a rough day, you're there. Be there for yourself the way you're there for others, as it's normal for these uncertain times to bring out negative emotions or anxiety. If you're finding it difficult to carry out daily tasks, there are solutions. Visit quebec.ca/gettingbetter or call Info Sociale 811. A message from the Gouvernement du Québec.
This message is intended for all Quebecers. We must take extreme measures to curb the pandemic. Only essential services remain open. Gatherings are prohibited. It's forbidden to leave your home between 8 p.m. and 5 a.m. These efforts aim to protect our healthcare workers, seniors, and loved ones. Let's comply with the lockdown and curfew to lower the risk of contracting COVID-19, because our health is important. For more information, visit quebec.ca/confinement. A message from the Gouvernement du Québec.
Thank you. evening and welcome to Amanda here on CKUT 90.3 FM in Montreal, CKUT.ca around the world. Tonight, Doug and I are here, not in the studio, very evidently. We're working from our homes under COVID, and rightly so. So I had the wonderful opportunity to talk to Feroz Manji of Diraja Press. This is part of our year-end review. Yeah, we're hitting mid-January, but we've decided to spread our year-end review over a couple of weeks. And I wanted to talk to Feroz about his wonderful podcast series, Organizing in the Time of COVID. We had featured a number of pieces from this series. So I thought a nice way to wrap up the year would be to talk to the producer of the series, Feroz, and ask him about some of the key themes that came out of discussions with progressive activists around the world on the issue of COVID and political organizing. So we'll have that for you tonight. And Doug, what about you?
Well, we're going to start with a continuation of the youth panel that Helden organized. She put together this idea sometime near the end of the year and proposed and got together with two of her dear friends from Africa. And they had a round table for a good hour. And it was a lovely podcast quality broadcast. So we're going to finish the second half